This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The actors who play defense attorneys on TV save a special sneer for the words circumstantial evidence. The expression suggests that the prosecution rests on nothing more than rumor, guilt by association, and incomprehensible science, that circumstantial somehow equates to flimsy. Well, some of the most famous cases in history, Sacco and Vanzetti, the Lindbergh kidnapping, the O.J. Simpson case, and the Oklahoma City bombing, were largely decided on circumstantial evidence. In fact, circumstantial evidence is the key in most criminal cases that get to court. A lot of experts regard it as more reliable than either eyewitnesses or confessions. Later in the program, what we're willing to admit to doing behind the wheel and why what's okay for you or me is dangerous when that other guy does it, plus your letters. But first, we're going to start a three-part series on law and order with circumstantial evidence. What is it? How is it used and misused? How has it played out in high-profile cases? Does circumstantial evidence mean we're more or less likely to get a fair trial? And what effect, if any, does it have on what type of defense people can afford? Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we'd especially like to hear from you if you've served on a jury and had to weigh different kinds of evidence. Was it confusing, compelling, what? Our number again, 800-989-8255, the email address totn@npr.org. Joining us now to help us answer some of these questions is Stephen Gillers, Vice Dean and Law Professor at New York's University Law School, who teaches courses on the rules of evidence, and he's with us from our bureau in New York, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
First of all, simple definition. What's the definition of circumstantial evidence?
Circumstantial evidence is simply evidence from which the jury has to draw inferences in order to reach a finding of guilt in a criminal case.
And that would be as opposed to eyewitness testimony, I saw him do it, or a confession, I did it.
That's right. If you imagine a homicide case, a witness who says, I saw Jones shoot Smith, is giving direct evidence. He saw the crime. However, if you have a witness who testifies that Jones's fingerprints were on the murder weapon and that Jones was seen fleeing from the murder scene and that Jones threatened Smith a week earlier, all that circumstantial evidence, it's not evidence of the crime itself, but evidence from which we may infer that Jones killed Smith.
So fingerprints, blood, semen, all that CSI stuff, that's considered circumstantial?
Right, with a high degree of probability. DNA evidence is circumstantial. It's not evidence from a witness to the crime itself, but it is highly probative of the fact that the defendant was at a particular place, perhaps at a particular time.
Mm-hmm. So just because it forces you to reach another conclusion, that's the definition of what circumstantial evidence is.
Exactly right. If the jury is required to draw inferences from the evidence offered by a prosecutor, for example, before it can conclude that the defendant committed the crime, it is relying on circumstantial evidence. On the other hand, if it simply has to believe an eyewitness is telling the truth when he says, I saw the defendant commit the crime, that's direct evidence. And the only issue there is, do you believe the eyewitness?
Okay. Now, at least in popular culture, circumstantial evidence is somehow considered less substantial and more tenuous than direct evidence. That's not accurate, is it?
It is entirely inaccurate. Circumstantial evidence can be quite compelling, especially as the various bits and pieces of circumstantial evidence accumulate. In fact, it can be more powerful than direct evidence. In the homicide example, if you imagine that the jury doesn't believe that one eyewitness, there goes the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's done. On the other hand, if the prosecutor has 15 or 20 pieces of circumstantial evidence, the jury might not believe three or four of them, and still conclude that the defendant is guilty.
I was reading in preparation for this program, one of the most compelling pieces of evidence in the case against Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, was circumstantial. A note that he wrote saying, TNT $5 cheaper, and such a date. And people found that incredibly compelling.
Yes, the thing to remember is that a piece of circumstantial evidence like that may not, and usually will not, by itself sway people toward a finding of guilt. Rather, it is the combination of various items of circumstantial evidence that leave the jury and the public with no place else to go but a finding of guilt. Whereas direct evidence, a piece of direct evidence, one single piece of direct evidence by itself can make the difference if you believe it.
But even, the most famous expression of, overwhelming guilt, the smoking gun, that's circumstantial evidence.
Well, it depends where the smoking gun is smoking.
if it's smoking in somebody's hand, all right.
Right. If it's smoking in someone's hand and the... But even there, technically, if we burst into a room and Smith is lying shot and Jones is holding a smoking gun, that's pretty strong evidence, but it's still circumstantial because no one actually saw Jones shoot Smith. It's circumstantial.
I saw that picture. He didn't. He was innocent.
Right. It may be that we can think of another explanation for what looks like a very incriminating set of facts. For example, Jones may have burst into the room 20 seconds earlier, seen the gun on the floor and picked it up, and then we burst into the room and see Jones with the gun. So we draw a conclusion that, in that instance, is wrong.
That was the mother-in-law who did it. Anyway, let's go to the phones. 800-989-8255. TOTN at NPR.org is our email address. Matt joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I was looking at a Supreme Court case here called Michalik versus Cleveland Tankers from 1960, in which the Supreme Court said circumstantial evidence may be, quote, more certain, satisfying, and persuasive than direct evidence. And I wanted to ask your guest if the Supreme Court is so satisfied and persuaded by this kind of thing, are juries going to be as satisfied and persuaded by circumstantial evidence, or are those words, like you were saying earlier, going to kind of set juries off?
I don't think it will set juries off, because remember that the jury, whatever it thinks when it comes into the courtroom and is sworn, will be instructed by the judge on the value of circumstantial evidence, and it will also hear the summations of counsel suggesting possible inferences the jurors might draw from the circumstantial evidence. So even if a juror subscribes to the popular culture view that circumstantial evidence is somehow not real evidence, by the time the case is over, I think jurors have been educated by the court and by the lawyers on the value of that kind of evidence.
Great. Thank you.
Matt?
Yes.
The Cleveland Tankers, was that the name of the football team then?
That's a good question. I believe it was, looking at kind of just a summary of...
I believe the football team was the Browns in those days, but I was just making a little joke. Matt, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's get another caller. Rachel joins us on the line from Goshen, Indiana.
Hi, Neil. This is Rachel.
Hi.
I served on a jury when I was a junior in college, which, it was a little bit tough then, obviously, because I had a few other things on my mind. But what I was really surprised by was that the testimony rested largely on an undercover policeman's testimony and 14 rocks of crack cocaine. And I don't understand whether the crack cocaine was circumstantial evidence or not.
Well, I need to know more, but I assume the rocks of crack cocaine were what the defendant was charged with possessing or selling.
Possession.
And if so, then if the drugs were found on the defendant's person, then they'd be direct evidence that he possessed it. If they were found in a place where the prosecutor said he had access and he claimed he did not, then they'd be circumstantial. So
okay.
A lot depends on where they are.
They found it in his truck.
Yeah, that's interesting because possession cases can require circumstantial evidence. A person charged with possessing drugs might say, well, it was in my house or it was in my truck, But I didn't know it was there, so I didn't knowingly possess it. And in order to convict someone, you have to show that they knowingly possessed it. So then the question becomes, what did they know? And oftentimes, the only way to prove knowledge absent a confession is circumstantially, by showing a pattern, for example, of drug dealing using the truck to convey the drug.
Or that he was a complete paranoid and never let anybody else use his truck.
Right.
Well, he wasn't too paranoid because that guy looked like an undercover cop. So. Well, the part that was most fascinating to me was that the jury wasn't convinced that it was crack, even though they had two lab scientists coming in there to talk about it, and they really didn't seem to understand scientific process. And I remember hearing the comment, well, that could be baking soda. And that was interesting that they got the chance to handle the direct evidence and they still weren't convinced.
Did they vote to acquit on that basis?
There were three charges, and we acquitted him on one possession charge.
Because they didn't believe the scientific evidence?
Correct.
Huh. Well, thanks very much, Rachel. That's very interesting.
Thanks.
And Professor Gillers, that does seem to suggest that maybe in some cases, anyway, that jury in particular thought circumstantial. Well, who's going to believe those experts?
Well, that's often true. If you remember in the O.J. Simpson case, there was a great deal of testimony and challenge to the DNA experts. And the defense claimed that the way in which the bodily fluids were tested was incompetent and could not be relied upon. So if you try to undermine what can otherwise be very powerful evidence, like DNA evidence, you can sometimes persuade a jury to have a reasonable doubt, which is all it has to have.
Hmm. Let's go to Chris now, who's on the line from Miami, Florida.
Hi, how are you, Neil?
Okay.
My question, Mr. Gillers, is I'm a former prosecutor, and my experience was that if you don't categorize evidence for a jury, and my experience was that it was usually the defense lawyer who was trying to do it, that you were better off. And my question, I guess, is do you think the label really of labeling evidence as either circumstantial or not really doesn't get you very far?
I mean,
the reason I ask is my experience was if you don't tell a jury that fingerprints are circumstantial, they will put immense weight on that kind of evidence without even knowing that it's merely circumstantial.
I think that's right. I think that a defense lawyer or anyone resisting a circumstantial case, including in a civil case, may have an interest in attaching that label to play into the popular culture belief that circumstantial evidence, because it requires additional inferences, is not as trustworthy, it's not real evidence, and therefore should be given little weight. And I think, therefore, that a prosecutor who has to prove every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt does not want the jury to distinguish between the two kinds of evidence, or even to hear that there are two categories, because very often, of course, some cases can only be proved circumstantially.
Well, Chris, there's another question. If the prosecutor, you in this case, or used to be you, doesn't categorize it, doesn't that give the defense attorney a chance to pop up and say, they're only talking about circumstantial evidence?
Yes, but it one forces them to try to split that hair, which is, in my experience, a very hard one sometimes to split. DNA evidence, I think. Well, I guess I would ask Mr. Gillers, would you categorize that as direct or circumstantial or evidence that could go either way? I think a jury, most juries confronted with DNA evidence, would find that more believable than almost any eyewitness.
It's almost irrelevant to try to put that kind of evidence in a category. Technically, I suppose, any evidence that depends on statistical probability, like DNA evidence or blood grouping or fingerprints, is circumstantial because there's another explanation for the evidence than the conclusion of guilt. However, given the remarkably high probability of accuracy of DNA evidence, it really is beside the point to categorize it one way or the other.
Chris, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking about circumstantial evidence. It's the first in our series on Law and Order. What it is, how it's used in trials, more of your calls after a break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email totn@npr.org. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is the Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what circumstantial evidence is, how it's used in criminal court cases. It's the first installment in a three-part series on law and order. Our guest is Stephen Gillers, vice dean and a professor at New York University Law School. If you've ever served on a jury and had to weigh the evidence presented and discussed whether it was difficult or easy, were you ever a witness at trial? Tell us about your experience with circumstantial evidence. The number is 800-989-8255-800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Joining us now on the phone from Los Angeles is Norman Garland, a former criminal defense attorney. He's going to be with us shortly, in a few moments, I suspect. I think that's him on the phone with our director in the studio. I apologize for prematurity there. While we're waiting for him to get up on the line, let's go to a caller, and David's on the line from St. Louis.
Thanks, Neil. I have to tell you, I'm a little concerned about a program making broad statements promoting the reliability of circumstantial evidence, or any other sort of evidence for that matter. I'm also troubled at presenting this discussion as a refutation of TV crime show defense lawyers. Circumstantial evidence is collected and presented by partisan investigators and prosecutors, and it can be manipulated. Now, perhaps the professor, if he's still on the line, can speak to the fact, historically, it was my impression that convictions based purely on circumstantial evidence were more suspect, because circumstances can be misleading and manipulated. In the instance you were discussing earlier of DNA, your guest said that it's very compelling. Well, that depends on a lot of facts, including, most especially, the reliability of and integrity of the lab doing the analysis and their diligence in protecting the evidence from contamination. I just don't see the value in urging the public, just as a blanket rule, to believe that circumstantial evidence is good, is necessarily good. I mean, a lot of people have believed eyewitness identifications was the most reliable of evidence for years, and with every day, more and more evidence.
Well, why don't we vilify one form of evidence at a time, David?
Okay.
Stephen Gillies?
Well, first of all, of course, if the DNA testing is sloppy, or any scientific test is sloppy, it undermines the credibility of the results. That's what happened in the O.J. Simpson case. Second, I emphasize and reaffirm that circumstantial evidence can be very valuable, and sometimes, as with certain kinds of crimes which are not witnessed by anybody, it's the only way to prove the crime.
You can't
categorically denounce circumstantial evidence. You have to look at the case itself and see.
By the same token, how can you promote it categorically, as this program seems to be doing?
Because categorically it is and can be as valuable as direct evidence.
And it is misleading. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, one of the reasons, if you listen to the list of historical cases we gave you at the beginning, at least some of them were quite suspect. The O.J. Simpson case, the Sacco Vanzetti case, the Lindbergh case, all of them largely based on circumstantial evidence.
Well, I think there are probably a lot of convictions that may have been entered in less notorious cases based purely on circumstantial evidence that was played skillfully by the prosecution that led to the conviction of innocent people.
Well, you use that phrase, purely circumstantial, which is why we're doing this program. Purely circumstantial,
sure.
Stephen Gillies.
My concern is that we seem to be just endorsing the reliability of circumstantial evidence as if it is just categorically reliable. It can also just as categorically lead to unjust convictions.
I categorically endorse the reliability of circumstantial evidence as trustworthy as direct evidence. My point is not that one is better than the other. My point is that in some cases, a stronger case can be made circumstantially, and that in any event, each is of some value to a lawyer. My second point, and I think this speaks directly to the caller's question, is that we're not only talking about prosecutors. Defense lawyers use circumstantial evidence. Lawyers in civil cases use circumstantial evidence. And they all do it because they understand its value. In our daily life, as you go about your daily business, you rely on circumstantial evidence to draw conclusions that lead you to make decisions about how you will behave.
Well, fine. I I wasn't hearing that part of the other side of the coin coming out. And it
well,
concerned
maybe your
me greatly.
Maybe your question helped bring it out, David. Thank you very much. Now let's go to our guest and our other guest, Norman Garland, who is now on the phone with us. He's a former criminal defense attorney and a former prosecutor, now teaches law at Southwestern College of Law in Los Angeles, and it's good of you to be on the program with us.
Hi.
You've seen circumstantial evidence used from both sides of the fence, so to speak. Can you tell us what your experience in dealing with this kind of evidence is?
Well, all of life, as well as all of life in trials, involves overwhelmingly circumstantial evidence. Even so-called direct evidence, eyewitness testimony, when you break it down, always contains a component of circumstantial evidence.
Well, can you give us a for instance?
Well, even if the eyewitness saw the defendant point the gun at the victim, pull the trigger, and a puff of smoke and a bang, the bullet could not be perceived. It takes the inference that the bullet went through the air and penetrated the victim's body. I mean, that's a ridiculous example, but it is, in fact, an instance of circumstantial evidence. Therefore, if you think about it, overwhelmingly, almost every case, criminal or civil, has in it a majority of the evidence being circumstantial, not so-called better direct evidence.
Well, is circumstantial more evidence? And you talked about the difference between criminal and civil cases, and one of the major differences in those two examples is, the standards of proof. Are there beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case, or the preponderance of the evidence in a civil case? Does circumstantial evidence, in that sense, be more useful in civil cases?
No, not at all. We can't live our lives without relying upon drawing inferences from what we perceive about us. So circumstantial evidence is involved in everyday living. It's involved just as much in criminal cases as civil cases. There is a jury instruction that's given in many jurisdictions, including California, where I'm from, that cautions the jury in a circumstantial evidence situation to be sure that it is convinced in a way that eliminates all other reasonable explanations. It's a very powerful jury instruction for the defense, one might say, although I relied upon it as well when I was a prosecutor.
Here's an email question we got from Steve Presson in Norman, Oklahoma. We have a legal rule in Oklahoma, he writes, which I think only lip service is paid to, that provides if a conviction is based solely on circumstantial evidence, that evidence must exclude every other reasonable hypothesis of how the crime happened.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's the jury instruction. It's called the Circumstantial Evidence Reasonable Doubt Instruction.
Do other states have that rule?
Many do.
Okay. And that's, that's why is that there?
It's there.
Why don't we let Stephen Gillard give that answer?
Well, it's there because it's part of the requirement of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. If there are other reasonable hypotheses that can explain the circumstantial evidence consistent with innocence, then by definition, there's a reasonable doubt. That's what reasonable doubt means. So I don't see that instruction analytically as adding or subtracting from the prosecution's burden, but it does call the jury's attention to the need to exclude all other possible explanations of the evidence.
Exactly.
Have you ever used that, knowing that that rule was going to be read to them by the judge, Norman Garland?
I've used it on both sides all the time because that's what the law is, and that's the way we function given the definition of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And in fact, as a prosecutor, I firmly believe that if I personally thought that there was some reasonable alternative explanation, I probably wouldn't bring the case. And, of course, a litigable case is where the prosecution feels that way one way and the defense feels that way the other.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a prosecutor or as a defense attorney, do you have a preference? I know that they're supposed to be weighed equally in the courtroom, but would you rather have direct evidence?
Not necessarily. It depends upon the credibility of the eyewitness. Some eyewitnesses are terrible witnesses.
And confessions?
Confessions are more powerful depending upon the circumstances, but they can be very weak depending upon the circumstances.
So it all depends, is what you're saying.
Of course.
And that's, I guess, why they have trials.
Yes, and in fact, in weighing direct versus circumstantial evidence and picking up on the last caller's complaint, When we try cases, we cannot create what happened historically absolutely with much degree of accuracy. We are doing the best we can. Life is a crapshoot in a sense in terms of trying to recreate what happened. If you ask two witnesses what they saw, you're not going to have perfect uniformity, and if you did, you'd think that they were suspect. Therefore, we just do the best we can, and these definitions have evolved over time to get us to that point.
But Stephen Gillers, I guess some of the questioning comes in when the best we can sometimes involves sending people away for very long periods of time, or perhaps even sending them to death row.
Well, it's terrible, the notion that we would convict the innocent, and we have learned through DNA testing that we do that. Very often, innocent people are convicted not through circumstantial evidence, but through mistaken eyewitness identification, where the eyewitness really believes that he or she is properly identifying the defendant as the culprit, but is wrong. And we learn it years later, perhaps through DNA evidence, a form of circumstantial evidence, technically speaking. So the best we can do, you see, we're talking about two different things. We're talking about the evidence, direct or circumstantial, that goes on a scale. You might think of it as a scale that the prosecutor in a criminal case has to weigh down with enough evidence. Whether the evidence is direct or circumstantial is only half the issue. The other half of the issue is how much evidence can the prosecutor put on the scale? Does the jury really respect the requirement that it find the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt after it weighs all of the evidence of both kinds? And that there we find that perhaps the importance of that burden of proof is not fully recognized.
Well, Norman Garland, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate you taking the time.
All right.
Norman Garland is a former criminal defense attorney as well as a former prosecutor. He is now a professor at Southwestern College of Law in Los Angeles. He spoke to us from his home there. We have a email remark, I guess, a comment from Rich Abbott. My favorite example of significant circumstantial evidence, defense counsel. Then you didn't really see my client bite off the plaintiff's finger, did you? Witness, nah, but I seen him spit it out. So there's an example for you. We're going to continue our conversation about circumstantial evidence in just a moment. Later in the program, we're going to be talking with the National Manager for Traffic Safety of the AAA about what Americans now are willing to admit they do behind the wheel, why they think it's risky when other people do it, but not necessarily, of course, when they do it. Later, of course, your letters as well. In the headlines today from NPR News, two Americans have been killed in a firefight with Iraqi gunmen in the town of Fallujah. Two Iraqis were also killed, six others taken prisoner. The clash highlights anti-American sentiment in that town in particular. And the Supreme Court has upheld the right of state workers to be included in the Family and Medical Leave Act. The federal law guarantees time off to care for children and ailing relatives. NPR's Nina Totenberg and Deborah Amos will have reports later today on those stories on All Things Considered. You're listening now to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Doug. And Doug joins us now. He's on a boat, he says, in Los Angeles Harbor.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I don't really have a question, just an observation. I was recently on a jury, and you're talking about circumstantial evidence. We had a lot of witness testimony that directly was against it. It was obvious that the witnesses on the stand were lying based on the statements that they had given police and everything before during the investigation. And one of the things that we were instructed was that we could basically sift through all the evidence and decide who was lying and what we were going to believe in all of this. And there was obviously a lot of stuff going on in the courtroom. This was a gang-related assault, and it was, you know, we in the jury room we were going through what we're going to believe, you know, and it was an interesting process. And the circumstantial evidence was the whole case. The only piece of real evidence that we had was that this guy had been shot, and he did in fact have a bullet wound in his foot. And so everything else we had to go on was circumstantial.
Well, after all the smoke and mirrors, I bet sometimes you really started questioning even that.
We we questioned everything. I mean, you know, one thing that we knew was that all of the witnesses who were not professional, and by that I mean court reporters and policemen and doctors, they were all lying to some degree. That was very obvious. And so it was hard to decide what we were going to believe.
Well, Stephen Gillis, I'm sure he's slandering officers of the court there.
No,
well,
no, actually, the officers of the court were great.
I was talking about the lawyers.
We had people who were definitely had bad experiences with officers of the court and police on the jury, and we all actually fell in favor of the court and the you know, judicial system and the police.
Yeah.
But it was definitely very interesting.
Okay, Stephen?
Yeah, you know, it's important to realize that no evidence is worth anything if you don't believe it. False evidence is not evidence. It counts as a zero, whether it's circumstantial or direct. And the first job of the jury is to decide whether or not the witness is credible. It is often said that the jury is the lie detector in the courtroom. If the jury doesn't believe a witness, in part, it may choose to throw out all of that witness's testimony, and it may question the credibility of the other witnesses called by the same lawyer. So that is an important function that the caller's jury performed.
Mm-hmm. One other question before we let you go, and that is, a lot of this, a lot of the circumstantial evidence is highly technical. Are defendants challenged to be able to pay for the kinds of tests and experts that they may need to either promote or try to explain away some circumstantial evidence?
Absolutely, and it's a very serious problem in American courtrooms where middle-class or poor defendants cannot afford the expert witnesses that the state can afford in criminal cases, the scientists, the DNA experts, and the like. The poorest defendants may get some modest financial help in hiring their own or hiring their own investigators. But even then, it's hard to match the resources of the state and state law enforcement in mounting that kind of technical defense. It's a problem we haven't really fully dealt with.
Well, Stephen Gillis, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stephen Gillis is vice dean and a professor at the New York University School of Law. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Next week, in part two of our Law and Order series, a look at what's being done inside prisons to keep inmates from becoming repeat offenders. When we come back, risky driving behavior. 91% of drivers polled in a new study admitted to doing at least one risky activity while driving in the last 6 months. So, are you speeding, eating, or reading while driving? What are you guilty of? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. Not while you're driving, that'd be risky behavior. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.